The Judiciary Committee will come to order. It is 1:31 in the afternoon of Wednesday, March 14th, 2012. We are here today for a confirmation hearing for the Attorney General, Michael Garrity. And I'll just say a couple words at the outset. This is one of the more serious tasks that the committee undertakes in confirming an Attorney General. This is probably one of the more powerful individuals that the governor will appoint. It's an extremely powerful job. Alaska, as we know, but the public doesn't always know, that we have an appointed Attorney General, not an elected one. And every couple of years, there's a push to elect our Attorney General, and I even entertained that idea until I sat down with Tom Stewart, who fixed my mind on that subject, and I haven't changed it since then. I think an appointed Attorney General is the way to go. Since I've been in this body, this is my seventh hearing on an Attorney General to confirm. So it's something that's kind of happening with a little more frequency, I think, than many of us want to see. The last Attorney General just served a year. I'm hoping that Mr. Garrity will serve longer. But the record since 2002 has been less than 2 years service for attorneys general. Mr. Garrity has had the good sense to bring his wife today, and he's had the good sense to salt the committee with one of his boyhood friends. So I think his likelihood of getting through the committee is pretty good. Nevertheless, it is a serious task we take up. I presented and provided to the Attorney General a few days ago a list of 11 questions, and I've done that for the last several nominees because I don't think anyone on the committee here wants to play, legal gotcha. Mr. Garrity is an extremely accomplished attorney, very knowledgeable. His background is very strong, and so it's not a question of gotcha. It's more like trying to get to some, interesting policy questions about which, the committee members individually or as a group and the Attorney General and the administration may differ, but we want to air those out today so that the rest of the state knows what it's getting. So it's my hope that we can do this in one hearing. We've been able to do it in one hearing for most attorneys general, but I'll turn now to just to let the record reflect that we have all members present, Senator Coghill, Senator Wilkowski, Senator McGuire, Senator Passan, and myself, Senator French. And we'll turn now to the Attorney General, let him give us some opening remarks. You can move through a couple of the questions as you like, and we'll proceed. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and you were very gracious to give me that list. I think my professional background and credentials were laid out in the materials that have been provided to the committee, at least I hope they have. Just on a personal note, and the chairman remarked on it, but I was born and raised in Fairbanks, as was my father in 1917, and my dad was a businessman up there for many years, but he was always partnered up with other people. He got hooked up with a number of other old Fairbanks and kids he grew up with, and stayed with those partners throughout his life and his business career, and it taught me the values of friendship, collaboration, loyalty, and I've tried to, something I've taken to heart and have continued in my own personal life and my practice. I've practiced with the same law firm for 33 years, I'm grateful for this opportunity to represent the state. You're the grandfather sitting on your left, and I did grow up together in Fairbanks in our formative years, and we lived down the street from the namesake of this committee. This committee room, Senator Butrovich. I was trying to remember if we ever got in trouble with him, but he would have been an exception because I won't say who was a bad influence on whom, but we did our share of mischief. But seriously, I'm here to answer the committee's questions. I will take those questions up as the committee presents them, and I'm looking forward to working with the committee on the challenges that face the state and the Department of Law.
Well, let's start with one of the perennial questions for new attorneys general, and that is, who do you work for? Who do you represent? Do you represent the people of the state of Alaska? Do you represent the Department of Law? Do you represent the governor? Who do you work for?
Well, by statute, I work for the governor and the office of the governor. Clearly, the governor's elected by the people, but I represent the office of the governor and the other branches, the other agencies within the executive branch, and to a great extent, I think that does represent the public interest and represent the people. But technically, my role is to give the governor the best possible legal advice I can and the best possible legal advice to the other executive agencies.
You've got your deputies, both your criminal deputies and your civil deputy attorneys here with you. Why don't you just sketch, let's turn to the criminal division first. What's the biggest challenge facing the criminal division. And within that challenge, please address sex assault, sex abuse, and whether prosecutions are increasing, and whether you bring any new ideas to combating this long-standing scourge of the state.
Well, I certainly agree with the chairman's characterization. You know, the criminal division, it's the timeless struggle of doing justice. And that means that the guilty do not escape unpunished, but also that the innocent don't suffer. So that's easy to say, but it's very difficult to do, as the chairman knows from his own experience. So I think the biggest challenges we face are keeping the good people. As the chairman again knows, young prosecutors want to get to trial work typically, but they join the department often with a substantial amount of debt from law school. So keeping those people beyond 5 to 7 years is always difficult. The lucrative private practice calls out, and so and this is not endemic to Alaska by any means. I think it's typical of prosecutors shops across the country. So, and Alaska is no worse, and I think a little bit better than the national average. So the chairman had some good ideas for trying to reach out to prosecutors, trying difficult cases, touching base with them, letting know that, you know, I think that personal touch is important, and I think it was a great suggestion. So I want to do what I can to connect with them personally and let them know I appreciate what they're doing. Try to establish more formal mentoring programs, perhaps, to give them the assistance they need, make them have maybe more of a program to second chair trials, give them the experience that they need. We can do that in Anchorage, I think, but it's difficult to do in some of the other districts. And so, you know, those are funding issues, and I look forward to working with this committee on that if we can present good, credible programs. But domestic violence, sexual assault, is a scourge. It's an embarrassment to us, or should be an embarrassment to us as a society. I must say, and I just want to digress for 1 second, of course, the governor, this is a top-down initiative, the Choose Respect initiative, which I learned about in my very first days in office. Coming from the private sector, it's easy to be a cynic about things like this, but I have to say I'm sincerely impressed with the laser-like focus that the governor's brought to bear on this. It's a top-down initiative. He feels very strongly about it, and well, he should, as well as all the rest of us. And so I take that very seriously. We've seen an increase in those referrals. Over the last several years, an uptick in referrals. I checked the Dillingham and I think the Bethel region as well. We're seeing an uptick in referrals and prosecutions in cases going to trial. I think in Anchorage, if you compare 2004 to 2007 to 2008 and 2011, and I may have those dates slightly off, but there's been a threefold increase in trials for serious sexual felonies and assaults. It's a little bit different because DV is often a component of a crime, a more serious crime, and so I think we need to work on how we track that a little bit better. But it has my attention and the attention and my chief deputy who's here with me, Rick Svobodny. They're not all young prosecutors. I've got a few grizzled veterans, and thank God for that. So it's something I take very seriously, we're tracking it. The Choose Respect initiative has created a matrix of indicia, if you will, to kind of monitor what's going on, both the prevalence of it, how often it's being reported, and so on. So the data is very new. There's only a couple years in it. But it's important that we do track it and kind of monitor our performance on it. So it's something we do take very seriously.
I appreciate the answer. The governor and I don't agree on every subject, but this is one that we totally agree on, and I think I speak for the entire committee. We appreciate the efforts that the administration is putting into this area, and so we thank you and the governor for that. And how about this? How about the civil division? The civil division is engaged in a wide variety of lawsuits and endeavors. What do you think is the single biggest challenge facing the civil division?
Well, the single biggest challenge is to keep moving aggressively on all these fronts. I don't know that I would prioritize one particular area over another, Mr. Chairman, the endangered species cases, the state-federal relationship cases, outer continental shelf, oil and gas litigation. There's just a number of different fronts, and they're all important. And so I'm not going to pick and choose among those, except to say that I think the turnover in this position has been unfortunate, as you point out, but I do intend to stay. And I think if there is an advantage to turnover, it's bringing in a fresh set of eyes and a fresh perspective from time to time on what the department's doing. And so, I intend to exercise that and to independently, if you will, evaluate what we're doing and how we're doing it. I also want to emphasize we have an excellent department, excellent attorneys, people with expertise in these areas, certainly more so than myself, and so I'm not going to reinvent the wheel, but I am, and I don't have any silver bullets to present here, but I will say and make the commitment that I'm re-examining what we're doing, and I intend to do that with everything the department does in the civil and the criminal side to see if there's a better way or more effective way that we can be doing what we're doing. But there's many challenges, as you say, on the civil side, and we're going to forge ahead.
You mentioned endangered species, and that was one of the specific questions I sent over to you, and I'll just rephrase it. In the last year, we've seen adverse rulings against the Department of Law in the polar bear, challenging the endangered species listing the polar bear, in the beluga whale, and a similar loss, there's no other word for it, in the Stellar Sea Lion case. Why are these cases, do you see more of these cases being brought, given the track record that the Department of Law has racked up in them?
Well, I do is a short answer. Let me say also while it's important to accountability is important, we need to examine, as I just said, what we're doing and how we're doing it. I don't necessarily keep a scorecard. I mean, it's not the best analogy, Mr. Chairman, but in the 50s and 60s, the NAACP was challenging, systemized segregation laws throughout the United States and didn't have a very good track record. If you're familiar with the history of that time period, it's kind of an embarrassing one for our country. The history I've read, it's hard to believe looking back from the perspective of 50 years just how entrenched that was. So, I wouldn't expect those people to take a look at their track record and how successful they were in challenges of statutes and back away. And I feel somewhat about the same about these issues. And I don't mean to equate the subject matters, obviously, but the point is that you need to keep fighting the fight. The laws change. Judges change, interpretations change. Endangered Species Act in particular is relying more on modeling. I mean, you and I may think of endangered as the species is actually threatened with extinction right now, but I mean, we're seeing listings with species that are healthy and robust, but because of modeling that's being done by the Fish and Wildlife Service and NIMS and so on, we're seeing projections and decisions made that are, depriving Alaskans of livelihood. And the Stellar Sea Lions is a good example, and I've been studying that case recently in the briefing and stuff like that, and I think we definitely have to appeal that. I'm reluctant to make policy based upon district court decisions, and so that's not to say it's a slam dunk on appeal before the Ninth Circuit by any means, but we're going to keep fighting the fight. I'm monitoring what we're doing. I'm not keeping a scorecard, but I'm not going to be dissuaded from going ahead with these cases where I think we've got merit. And I've met with Fish and Game and talked to them about things we could be doing better, maybe tracking some of our own species, trying to develop our own science, being more proactive, rather than just going to court all the time, but trying to develop some credibility perhaps with these listing agencies. We'll never develop credibility with the NGOs that bring these listing decisions and file these petitions, but we're going to continue the fight. It's important, and I think the science is really getting pushed out there, and I hope we can get some progress with the courts on challenging some of these assumptions.
Let's any follow-up questions based on that? Let's stick with the wildlife topic then. There's a recent news articles about a fish and game initiative that would give special hunting privileges to some private landowners. The story noted the involvement of an assistant attorney general in developing the proposal. Our Constitution, as you know, provides that all state resources, including including wildlife, are reserved to the people for common use. What are your thoughts regarding the Constitution's provision of common use versus the provision of special hunting permits for landowners?
Well, I think the Constitution obviously trumps providing special privileges to anyone under our Constitution for natural resources. I'm not familiar with the article. I did look into it after I got the questions, Mr. Chairman, and I think what was being referred to, and I don't know how it came across in the media or the news report that you referred to, but to take one example, bison in the central as the Big Delta region, that's a very sought-after permit, hunting permit. It's done by lottery, obviously. There's a lot of large farms, private holdings in the Delta area, and unless those farmers open up their land to hunting, those permit holders can't hunt, and bison would otherwise roam and graze on those properties. So if a private landowner was, for example, to open up his private land, not state lands, but his property to hunting and allow the state to advance the goal of sustained yield and conservation of the species, and so and this special this landowner allowed people to go hunt on his property, which would advance, I think, the state's goals under the Constitution, and he were to do this for a period of time, for example, would it violate the Constitution if the state were to give him a special permit in consideration or recognition of his efforts after he's held allowed hunting on his private property over an extended period of time? I'm not giving a legal opinion on that now, but that's the type of circumstance that I think was maybe being had been brought up, and I'm not sure how it came across in the news report. Native corporations would be another example. Again, I'm not don't have anything concrete there by way of example, but I think you can see the principle. If the state can advance its goals by soliciting the cooperation of private landholders to assist in allowing maximum use, maximum hunter privileges, and so on, and maximum number of people to bag game with these permits and so on, I think that advances the state's goal under the Article 8. And so if they could get a special permit in exchange for that, I think that's a win-win. We're not there yet. I'm not aware of any specific proposal on the table, but that is the type of idea I think that we're talking about. And obviously the devil's in the details, and you know, we're not there yet. But that responds to your question. I think that's what we were talking about.
I understand the policy direction, and I think it's a good answer. Follow up. Let's turn to, you mentioned Native Corps. Let's turn to tribes and Native sovereignty. We recently had a crime summit. We had Walt Monaghan in front of us, a distinguished public servant, now working for the Alaska Native Rights Native Justice Center. I'm sorry, Native Justice Center. And he brought up the sort of continuing and difficult issue of providing justice to small rural communities and villages. Most of those areas, many don't have a police officer at all. If they do have police officers, it's a VPSO. There's very little state government involved there. And he said, you know, one idea you might consider is creating tribal or maybe a less charged word would be community courts. And so I'm wondering what you think about an idea along those lines. And in your answer, you may want to touch on some recent cases involving Native sovereignty with respect to the state in the child support arena and other civil corridors.
Well, first of all, I want to commend the chairman for his crime summit and his initiative in this area. I read the report. I wasn't able to attend the commission itself, but I commend the chairman. To digress for one second, when you talk about challenges facing the criminal division, certainly Bush Alaska is a big challenge for many reasons, many obvious reasons, but and for the reasons that you referenced, no presence by the state, no courthouses, no state troopers, and it's so that is a big challenge that always will face the criminal division, I'm sure. I want to be open-minded about this. I think but it has to be balanced. On the one hand, I want to be open-minded. On the other hand, the tribal members, the people that live in these villages, are guaranteed rights under a state constitution. Right now, tribal courts and the state courts have concurrent jurisdiction. There's no Indian country, nor do I think we want to go back to that position. So people who want to participate in a tribal court proceeding, and if the tribal court has jurisdiction and it's an ICWA proceeding, for example, that's fine. I mean, I think the court, Supreme Court affirmed that in the Tananaw case, the Alaska Supreme Court did recently, and of course you go back to John versus Baker, and that's the law of the land. I mean, I think tribal courts are here to stay unless Congress does something to change that jurisdiction. But it's in very limited, narrow areas, and ICWA is one where it is the primary one, and there's some offshoots of that, but certainly the domestic relations level and child support, child custody, adoption, so on and so forth, that's where the focus is now. I think the former chief brings up a good issue, and one that, you know, I'm going to keep an open mind about, but typically, we've not given the tribes criminal jurisdiction. I have a lot of issues with that. We will give full faith and credit to a tribal court order in an ICWA proceeding or an ICWA-related proceeding if they comport with due process. But the Superior Court of Fairbanks came down with a decision last week that refused to give full faith and credit because there weren't what we would accept as attorneys is the common everyday protections, notice, opportunity to be heard, and so on. And so there's many tribes, and there's probably many levels of sophistication among these tribes, but I'm going to keep an open mind about it. Anything where we don't have a presence and people are trying to do the right thing in their communities, I think we have to respect that. We also have to respect their rights as citizens under the state and the due process rights that they're afforded. If tribes are interested in finding a way to somehow strike a balance where, you know, both goals can be met, I want to keep an open mind about it. But it's many difficulties, many challenges with that, and I'm going to be conservative about it in terms of my. But I'm going to keep an open mind. I'm willing to talk to people about it.
I appreciate that. I'll give Walt Monaghan your phone number. Senator McGuire.
But two questions, not on that subject.
Please.
Okay. My first question is with respect to AG opinions. How have you used them in your practice through your many years in Alaska, and how do you intend to approach them as an attorney general? Some attorney generals are more active in terms of generating those opinions, and some are more reactive in terms of generating them when asked and inserting themselves into a particular issue.
Well, through the chair, Senator McGuire, first of all, in private practice, over 33 years, I can't say didn't have occasion to refer to one or use one, but as I sit here, I just don't have any concrete examples for you. I know what they are, I know what they're intended to do, but my experience with them in private practice was frankly limited. Since I've assumed this position, I'm not aware that we've issued any, and I don't recall them coming up in the context of whether we have to issue any. My philosophy about it in general is to be conservative. Try not to be a reactive kind of guy, and I like to be measured in my response and. I won't say slow, but I'll say measured and deliberate in deciding whether they need to be issued. But, for example, you know, the Tananaw case that I referred to earlier was in response to a 2004 Attorney General's opinion. Mm-hmm. And there weren't any specific facts of a case or a contested proceeding there. It was just an opinion. In hindsight, perhaps ill-advised. I don't know enough about the history of it, but averse to using it necessarily as a vehicle for policy. I don't think that's, I'm not sure that's appropriate, but when issues do come up and the practitioners or the citizens, companies doing business here need guidance, and I feel that there is a clear path or a clear answer that I can give in an attorney general opinion to assist people who need to do commerce in the state or live in the state, you know, I think that's something we'll do. But it's not something in the almost 2 months here that I've had occasion to come across or to actually deal with.
Excellent. Actually, two more, and then I'll be done. We just had the our Chief Justice Carpinetti speak to us. Really, really wonderful State of the Judiciary last week. And you heard part of it from the chairman with respect to young Natives in particular and the recidivism rates, the concept of circled tribal justice and things. But a broader concept that he spoke to us about was presumptive sentencing and a question about whether or not it was time for the legislature, perhaps the governor, all of us to look at what we're doing with respect to presumptive sentencing, the high recidivism rates that we still have, and the fact that as a judge, there isn't as much latitude to exact justice anymore. And I guess I just wanted to hear your thoughts. I wondered if you heard it, his speech, and then if you had some thoughts about presumptive sentencing.
I was in the gallery, Senator McGuire, and I did listen to it, and I complimented the Chief Justice later. We had a meeting that afternoon. I thought it was an excellent speech, very difficult subject, very dense subject even, which he forewarned the audience about as he was giving his speech. But, you know, presumptive sentences were, I'm not going to say a fad, but they were 30, 40 years ago, and they were enacted at the federal level as well. I guess people were concerned that the judges were giving out, being too lenient and so on and so forth, and there was a backlash, and so they set presumptive sentences. I don't think the Chief Justice ripped sentencing guidelines, as the headline in the Empire suggested, but he raised, I thought, very legitimate issues about the lack of discretion. It's something the federal judges have bristled under as well, well known. And when you're a judge, you like, that's part of what you do, is you decide what's right and what's just. 30 years ago, that was tens of millions of dollars ago for this state in terms of what we spent on prisons and corrections, if not hundreds of millions. So, and you look at California now where their prisons are full. So there's a price to pay with presumptive sentencing, I think, which is that you end up potentially putting a lot of people in prison who may not belong there. The Chief Justice, and I have not read the three reports that he referenced in his speech, but if there's now empirical data that we could look at, or you could look at as lawmakers, and to see, you know, it's that one-third that are going to reoffend probably no matter what you do, the other third that will probably never reoffend regardless, and then it's that middle third that are kind of on the fence that we need to be concerned about. So I don't have any silver bullets, but I do think it's a very important subject. I think that presumptive sentencing should be reviewed and looked at, and if there's some way we can find a way to keep these young people out of prison, whether they be in the bush or in the urban areas, absolutely. I thought it was a very important speech, and it resonated with me.
And last a point and then a question. Some of us in the legislature have taken it upon ourselves to get involved in national organizations and even international organizations as an opportunity to learn more about how other systems of government work. And so part of it is I want to ask you if you've thought yet about getting involved in the National Organizations for Attorneys State General and what your thoughts are about that. And then finally, I want to know, as a part of that and you're finding your way and thinking about how you'll use your time and energy, after your term is completed, how do you want to be remembered in Alaska state history for your time and service as our Attorney General?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, I did attend the NAG meeting, National Association of Attorneys General, last week, Washington, D.C., in part because I was told that I would be hosting the meeting in June. NAG will be meeting in Anchorage, and so they thought it would be a good idea for me to go. And the Washington meeting is kind of the most important of the, I think they have three meetings each year. So We'll be hosting the summer meeting. So I did go, met a number of attorneys general, very interesting programs. I did meet with Secretary Salazar and with about half a dozen other AGs, Western AGs. Of course, he himself is a former Western AG and was active in what they call CWAG, which is the Coalition of Western Attorney Generals. But I had a chance to talk to him and express some views, and we had a very a good exchange. He's a very gracious man, but I hope to continue relationships like that and meet people at that level and find out, you know, how things are being done in their jurisdictions, and it's a reference or a resource for me to use, and how we can do things better as a department. So anyway, it's a good organization. I'm going to do participate in that, and we'll continue. I think we all want to be we want to be remembered as a good father and a good husband, obviously. So that's the bottom line. And from there, if I can emerge from this job in whenever that may be, with my independence and my integrity intact, and with the respect of this body and the respect of the governor, I suppose that'll be a pretty good day at the office. So otherwise, I don't have a big, ambitious agenda here except to do the best job I can.
Thank you.
Senator Passman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly, I want to convey to you, Mike, and to everyone on this committee, you are someone that I have the highest level of respect for. And certainly going back to childhood, but over the last 30 to 40 years, watching you develop your law practice and in Fairbanks originally and then on to Anchorage. And so anyway, certainly I think that this is a fine moment for the state of Alaska to have you as a nominee for Attorney General. So I think it's a great day.
Thank you.
I think you're going to be an awesome Attorney General. Specifically, though, what I would like to hear your thoughts, one of the big issues that is before the state of Alaska right now is the Point Thompson litigation and those issues that are before the courts. And kind of if you could provide your thoughts generally as to the Point Thompson legal issues, and then translating that maybe to a more general concept, which is a matter of, I think, much concern right now to committee members on this committee and throughout the legislature on the concept of leasing on the North Slope, and under those leases companies receive exclusive rights for many, many years, and the general concept of a duty to actually explore, actually develop, and actually produce. So within those two areas, again, the Point Thompson legal issues, and then generally on the duties under leases to actually explore, develop, and produce.
Well, the Point Thompson case is and I thank you again, Senator, for your personal remarks. I'm grateful for that. That was argued about a week after I took the position. I mean, the die was pretty much cast. I've not gone back to read the briefs. What I know as a layperson or as an informed citizen before that time is that the state acted to terminate or default the lessee for failing to live up to obligations under the lease. So that's a very fact-intensive inquiry. I would point out we're now 5 years into it, so it's not a slam dunk ever, I don't think. I do agree that the leases are contracts. They should be enforced. I've looked at the DL leases, DL1, the newer leases, and the older leases, and it's up the reasonable and prudent operator standard, taking into account the interests of the lessor and the lessee. So it's, we would say as lawyers, it's one of those issues that typically is going to have to go to a jury, because that's a very fact-intensive, kind of amorphous and vague standard. The cases tend to suggest that the profit issue is more of a short-term perspective from what I've been able to find out. But I think the burden is on the royalty owner to make that showing. So it's It's very fact-intensive, but there's leases out there, and I view those as enforceable agreements. I think DNR has some leeway through the plan of operations and plan of development process to try to influence the development of a particular lease, particularly when it goes into a unit, and on an annual basis, the lessee has to, you know, provide those plans. And I think, and I'm not privy to that process, it's a different department, and I defer to Commissioner Sullivan, obviously, but I think there's some influence there, some way that the state can make its interest known or encourage the lessee to take steps to further develop the field, perhaps. But otherwise, Point Thompson, I think, could be an exception. I mean, I think it's a mistake to believe that we can litigate ourselves to prosperity. And as I said, that case was a pretty, I don't know how many plan of developments had been submitted, 22 or 23 or something like that, before the state acted. And here we are 5 years later, and it's going to get remanded again. So I'm cautious about it, but I will say if something's brought to my attention, you know, a specific lease, a specific set of circumstances, and the specific facts, you know, we'll take a look at it. I'm not going to pass judgment on it now, but it's just, I think it's a difficult question to answer in the abstract. There are agreements. The leases do have requirements in there. They take into account the interests of both sides, the lease, not just the lessor. And, you know, there's some loaded terms in there, like reasonable and prudent operator and reasonable profit and stuff like that. I mean, over what period of time, what rate of return, there's all kinds of issues there. But, you know, if it's brought to my attention, we'll take a look at specific facts and circumstances.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Pasfan has said nothing but good things about you as well to us, so you must be good. I want to follow up on that question. I know there was a question asked in the, but this is probably a good time to get to it. You talked about the DL1 leases, which are the older leases, and there's a lot of land, a lot of property that's covered under those. But the newer leases, I think, I'm hoping that we fix the problem. I don't know if you've reviewed the newer leases, the ones that probably in the last 10 years or so, we specifically do have a provision that says there's an obligation to produce when the companies can make a reasonable profit. And I know that was one of the questions that was asked, but this is probably a good time, I think, to talk a little bit about that. How would you define a reasonable profit?
Well, let me back up, and if I misspoke or if I'm mistaken, I'll stand corrected to Senator Wilkowski, but I believe the DL1 is the newer version of the lease, and then we have, or at least my understanding was, that it is an older version of the lease, but regardless of this, I'll stand corrected, but I get your point. You know, frankly, I'm not sure I'm qualified to opine about what a reasonable and prudent operator does. I do think that's a standard in both the leases that the state uses. And again, I don't think that doesn't detract or take away from anything I just testified to. It's an enforceable agreement, and Point Thompson is a prime example. So I have no problems with that, no qualms about enforcing the leases in the proper circumstances, but I'm just not qualified to make that judgment, and now, you know, with all respect to this committee, I'm not sure anybody in this committee is qualified to opine about what a reasonable and prudent operator would do, if I may say that. But we'll take a look at it. As I said, if the circumstances are presented, you present with facts, here's a lease or a unit development, and this is what's going on, and we feel like they're not performing, meeting their obligations in the lease, you know, then they've got something concrete and specific to deal with, and I will look at it very seriously.
Yeah, just follow up on that. The current leases, the ones that I've read anyway, specifically say that there has to be production development when the companies can make a reasonable profit. The old standard is what you've mentioned, which is the reasonable prudent operator, considering the lessee and the lessor. But the newer leases specifically say you got to develop when it's a reasonable profit. So you would evaluate that? And I guess I'm curious if you've given any thought to what you talked about, reasonable prudent operator, but this is a reasonable profit standard. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that. And if you don't, then who how would you analyze a case that was brought before you? Would you hire expert witnesses? If I came before you with a set of facts that showed billions of dollars in profits and a very high rates of return, How I'm just curious how you would go about analyzing that. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I'm sure we would have to retain consultants to advise us. I mean, we have a very experienced oil and gas section, and I would go to them first, obviously, to get the, you know, the essentials. But I think, I'm not sure people within oil and gas are qualified to testify what a reasonable profit is either, or to go in and make a showing for it. I mean, the senator's a distinguished longtime attorney. He knows this as well as I do. So we would have to retain experts. We'd have to look at the facts. The reasonable rate of return, as I said, over how what period of time? The cases suggest that it's on the obligations of the royalty owner to show that, make that showing, and it's typically a shorter period than a longer period. But the cases, I don't think there's any hard and fast rule to say it's 3 years versus 5 years or 1 year, and at least I'm not aware of that. What rate of return are we talking about? Again, the cases suggest it's not the profitability of that specific lease, it's the industry's profitability. And so, again, that is certainly something that people can opine about, and you can find out in research. And so that's what I would do. We would look at the facts that were presented to us. We probably, in all likelihood, would have to retain an expert. We can certainly consult with DNR. A DOR may have some insights as well, so I wouldn't rush to retain an expert necessarily, but at the end of the day, if it's something that I wanted to test to see if it's something that has the strength to go to court to prevail upon, I would bring in and consult outside experts.
Thank you. And since, as you pointed out, it can be a challenging standard for which it would be difficult for you to define, for the committee to define. Do you think it's probably better, because these are what the Department of Law, in conjunction with DNR, these are the lease terms that are we're currently putting out. So in other words, if we're putting out terms that you're saying this committee is not qualified to decide and you're not qualified to decide, do you think maybe we should write terms that are a little bit more easier for everyone to understand? Maybe put in the contracts, in the leases themselves, obligations, so that we don't have to go through 5 years of litigation. Do you think that might be a better practice for us to go through?
It could be. I don't know the answer to that. It could be. I know, I believe the chairman and perhaps yourself introduced a bill talking about when you bid in a lease that you put in some financial terms of what you're going to. That's a reasonable idea. Again, I'm not passing judgment on the merits of that either, but there's different ways of going about it, whether we could be more precise. I don't know. Maybe at times it's good to have the flexibility, frankly, of a standard. The downside is that it's, you know, it could be one thing to a lessee and one thing to the state, but by the same token, sometimes if you get too specific, you may be, you know, hurting yourself to do it. If oil prices were to drop suddenly, maybe the profit is not what we think it is, and we put a profit in the lease that might be artificially high, for example. I mean, there's any number of hypotheticals, Senator, and I just, but, you know, again, you've got some ideas, and I just don't have any silver bullets about that, but my only point is, if I have a point from this, and I want to make this point, litigating yourself to prosperity is not a good goal, in my view. We need to have a cooperative type of arrangement, and I think the lawsuit angle is, and I think Point Thompson proves that to some extent. It's just not a very, it's not a sound policy, in my view.
So, well, and I would tend to agree with you, except the Point Thompson case, I think, is sort of a perfect example where we sat back and we didn't litigate. We gave the producers 30 years through 23 plans of development. And so at some point, the state has to act as a sovereign and has to say, we demand that you do the duties required under your lease. So I certainly agree with you. Litigation is a last resort, but I think what we're seeing on the North Slope is you've got 25% of the leases, hundreds of leases, which are just sitting idle. You've got Point Thompson, the largest undeveloped oil and gas reserve in North America, sitting idle for 30 years. So I guess the state, while I would agree generally, you don't want to engage in litigation unless you have to, I think there are times where you have to. You have to absolutely say, we're the sovereign, and we want our leases developed.
Senator, you're absolutely right. And I hope nothing I've said is misconstrued to suggest otherwise. But if you're talking about 25% of the leases, and I will defer to you, I know you're on the Senate Resources Committee and have spent a lot of time on this subject, far more than I have, so I respect that. But, you know, you're talking probably about a number of different claims, a number of different challenges there. So, Point Thompson, I view as, you know, absolutely right. The state waited long enough, and it enforced its rights. But it's never as clear-cut as we'd like to think it is. And as I said, we're now 5 years down the road with what I thought were pretty good facts, based upon what little I did know about it as a citizen. And so there, and we all know this from our own practice. It's, you know, there's two sides to these stories, and people invariably, it's just never as concise as we would like it to be. But absolutely, there's a point at which the state has to act. That's my responsibility. I don't want to ever do anything that shirks our rights as a sovereign and to turn a back on that, regardless of how difficult it may be or the consequences or anything like that. I do agree with that, Senator.
I think you sense there's a strong interest in this subject in the committee, and I appreciate your nuanced view of it. It is a nuanced subject. You can't just draw black and white lines and expect a court case to develop along those parameters. Point Thompson, you know, completely green field, not touched, a great case for us to bring, and it has been a difficult one. And I think what Senator Olakowski and I have been interested in is whether that same idea applies to the North Slope in general. Whether there is a threshold upon which you can then turn to the industry and say, you're not developing this. You're carrying cash out of Alaska to invest someplace else when you can make a reasonable profit here. And it would be an extremely difficult case, but I would encourage you, you come from a sophisticated business background in your practice, and I would encourage you to think about that. You've got a client of not only the governor, but 600,000 citizens who have their inheritance up there on the North Slope, and they want to see it developed in a reasonable manner.
Well, I appreciate that, and I have a role in enforcing the state's laws. All I can say is that all these acreages are covered by leases. They may be old leases or newer leases, and they've got the language in it that's in them. It is what it is. If it's just difficult for me to answer in the abstract, I guess is what I'm saying, Mr. Chairman. It's something I take a look at in a specific context, but I'm cautionary about it. I hope that has come across.
It's extremely fair. But also think about it, and as you think about it more specifically, whether we're missing some language in those leases that could structure a better business relationship. It doesn't have to be antagonistic. It doesn't have to be us hauling them to court to force them to abide by the terms. If we structure it differently from the outset, we can go down the road as better partners from the very beginning. We're the landlord, they're the tenant, but we each have something the other side wants, and so it doesn't have to be a courtroom experience if you structure it right from the first place.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Further questions from the committee? I've gone through most of these. But actually, why don't you, just for the record, the public, we've gotten your resumes and we've met with you in public or in private and heard about your background, but just tell us a little bit about where you went to law school, what you did right when you got out and so forth, and just kind of give us a little bit of your personal background, so while we're on the record.
Sure. Well, I attended the University of Santa Clara Law School in Santa Clara, California, graduated in 1978. I may have graduated with honors, but don't quote me. I did participate in moot court, and we had a wonderful experience of winning our law school moot court competition and competed in the California state championships, which I don't recall that we finished at the top of that heap. But I've always enjoyed moot court and appellate courts and stuff like that. So
you graduated from law school in 78.
1978, and I went to work for a firm, an Anchorage firm that had an office in Fairbanks. And about 6 months after that, I was approached by Ed Mertes, who some of you may remember. He's long gone now, but I played basketball with his sons, and Ed had a way of appealing to the jock side of my nature and said, you've got to come to work for us. And This is, you know, anyway, you could talk the shirt off your back, a great man and a great Alaskan, but I ended up going to work for his firm, which at the time was, I think, Murdy, Scheibel, Staley, and Delisio. In Fairbanks, 1981, I moved to Anchorage and practiced with that firm there. About 15 to 20 years ago, I want to say, the offices, we parted company to you know, a mutual basis. It was nothing angry or about it. It was just we the offices and the practices were sufficiently different. We thought it would make sense to split the sheets, so we did. We stayed close friends with them, and I have many many friends in Fairbanks.
And what sorts of cases were you doing?
Well, I've over the years, I've done quite a bit. I've tried condemnation cases. I've tried cases against bus companies, against brokers, tried cases for the state, for the municipality of Anchorage, architects, engineers, construction companies, just a very broad practice. I've represented plaintiffs in the sense of businesses, suing other businesses. I've defended cases primarily in state courts, but also some in federal courts. I've probably tried somewhere north to 20 to 30 cases, perhaps, and maybe 20 cases the Alaska Supreme Court. I've kept more careful track of those because it's on their webpage. But it's a broad practice. The common denominator has been the litigation and trial work. And but I, over the years, that the emphasis in that has taught me the value of avoiding litigation and trials. And I've always tried to view myself as a problem solver, a communicator, trying to find, you know, you're never going to get anywhere if you can't talk with people and talk about what you, identify your differences first, and then try to find some common ground. And so I've prided myself on that and trying to maintain open communication with opposing counsel to get through as many things as we can, because we invariably have plenty of hard things to fight about. So that's been the one constant of practice. I've also drafted agreements, drafted contracts, you know, a variety of things. So it's been a very, it's a fairly broad-based practice. I've had cases against this gentleman on your left here over the years. And,
How those work out?
I, you know, I don't remember, but I'm sure he got the advantage. I mean, he did that when we were kids too. So.
Any criminal defense work?
Not really. No, I did have a significant matter in the early '90s. Contractor client, who's a Native Corporation subsidiary, was indicted on the North Slope for homicide. I think it was the first time the state had indicted a corporation for a homicide, and a very tragic death involving a welder's helper on the slope. And the corporation was eventually indicted, as was the project manager, who was a professional engineer, you know, running a job, 200 or 300 people on it. So it was a very, very unfortunate set of circumstances. But Jim Gilmore and I represented the corporation, and Dave Stewart and Peter Gruenstein represented the project manager, and we had a month-long trial in Barrow. And so that was
what month, what month of the year was that?
That was, I want to say, in the winter or late winter. It was grim, but, you know, not that grim. But anyway, it was that was a, I don't typically do criminal law, but that case, there was also a very huge OSHA fine that had been assessed against the contractor, and so I was, and there were civil claims, and so I was involved in various aspects of it, and I did try the criminal case with co-counsel. But otherwise, no, over the years, I've not. I've got involved in APOC proceedings before, and disclosure issues, arbitrations, and so on, but the criminal law, no, I've managed to not, I don't specialize in that.
Other questions? Senator Coghill.
This is probably not going to be as well thought of as I like, but in every department in state government, you have Department of Law people helping them with counsel. And it's been my experience that quite often government can be some of the citizens' worst enemies. So I think you find yourself in a conundrum there. You know, we get to hear about it as legislators. We get to hear the constituents' complaints. It's really just, I don't have a question. It's a concern that the Department of Law sometimes gets maybe a little myopic to the department. And so it's just it's a concern that I've seen as a legislator, and I just wanted to bring it up. The other thing, Mr. Chairman, is we've been working on the privacy laws, you know, trying to figure out how to keep up with the internet and all the things that can happen with databases all over the world, it seems like. And I think we've done a pretty good job of protecting ourselves here. The previous Attorney General went to bat immediately when there was a breach that affected a lot of Alaskans. So it's something that we watch very closely, and I just wanted to bring it up as a topic is an ongoing issue. But protecting the people of Alaska as an Attorney General, you have to be very swift in this this day. And so any of the laws that have big gaps in them, certainly I'm interested in, because I think protecting the privacy of Alaskans can be one of our key tasks as we move forward.
Well, it's the Senator knows, thank you, it's guaranteed under our Constitution, the right of privacy. So it's something I take very seriously. On your former point, let me just say, you know, we literally have thousands of open files. And so if we try to be perfect, but obviously we're not. But if something comes to your attention that is a concern, please bring it to my attention. That doesn't mean we're going to achieve perfection, but I intend to follow up on these things and to find out what happened and to give a response. So I just encourage you to do that. I just leave it at that, and I certainly concur with you about the right of privacy and protecting the privacy rights when there's kind of breaches. And so, absolutely.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Yeah, just a comment. But my office has been working on an issue in our district for some constituents about regarding TORA agreements, and we contacted you when you and I spoke about it, and I just want to thank you for your prompt response, because must have been a couple days after that you had been contacted that things started to open up, and I. Some very happy constituents because of what you've done. So thank you for your prompt response.
Well, thank you, Senator. To be fair, that initiative started under my predecessor, so I don't want to take credit for it. But when it was brought to my attention, I thank you for bringing it to our attention or reasserting it. I mean, I thought it was something we could and did solve. So I appreciate it and invite the other members of the committee, if they have an issue, to do as you did. But thank you.
I will take advantage of that, and this, I don't think this has been brought to your attention, but it's something that someone asked me to raise if we had a minute. We do have a minute. This is a letter that actually was sent to two attorneys generals ago, Dan Sullivan, a good attorney general, that was asking him about marine pilotage and the state laws with respect to the new areas in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, where we're going out beyond the three-mile limit, and whether or not pilotage laws would apply there, and what sort of guidelines the state board could get from the Department of Law. I don't know if the letter was ever answered or what happened, but I just thought I'd bring that to your attention. I'm not asking for a response now, but it's a letter I'll get you a copy of after this meeting. And it's an interesting issue. It's got a big impact on future development in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. And so I'll just give you a copy when we're finished here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hate to profess ignorance, but on that one, I'm going to have to. But I will follow up on it. See, hopefully something was done, and I'll follow up with your staff. Thank you.
Very good. Further questions? I don't see any. You've done a remarkable job of keeping three lawyers stumped here after just an hour. So I think that speaks well for your conciseness. I appreciate that. Senator Wilkowski.
Chair, I would move that we move forward the name of Michael C. Garrity to a joint session for consideration. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of Mr. Garrity.
Is there objection to forwarding Mr. Garrity's name out of the committee? Hearing and seeing none, it is done. Congratulations. Thanks again for being here. It's pleasant to meet your wife. Go out and enjoy a sunny afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're adjourned.